Good evening. We have two new faces tonight. Welcome. How did you hear about Floating Zendo?
Her dad
told us. Oh, good. Nice. Have you been to the Wednesday night group?
I'm going to go tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
For Monday twice.
Great. Great. She's a wonderful teacher.
Very easy to understand.
Yes. Yes, she is. Clear as a bell.
Yeah.
let's do introductions around. And Angie. You won't remember any of those names. But I'm glad you could find us tonight. We're just about to begin a new study. I brought a ton of paper with me. If my husband hadn't been working in the paper industry to make paper cheaper to make all for many, many years, I would feel very guilty about this. But I don't, because we paid our dues. I brought you all a copy of the Diamond Sutra, the red pine one. So, of course, the red pine book is, this is the size of the Diamond Sutra, like this. But the book is this thick with commentary. And what I've done is use his commentary to pull out things that I felt would be interesting to talk about. Thank you, Ritu. Maybe you could pass it the other way. And I think I'll do a handout each week so that you have what I pulled out to reference as you go back and read the sutra. It's really quite short. And it looks very simple until you try to make sense of it. And it's like the Mirror Sutra that we've just finished. You have to read it from down here on your heart and down here in your belly. It's not logical, except in a way that your heart will recognize. But perhaps the rest of you might, if you try to figure it out, it doesn't figure very well. So this is the first maybe I'll hand out the other thing first. And I don't know how many of you are interested in this, but this is some of Kenneth Roshi's music. I just pulled three things out. One is in the Seigaki ceremony when the priest says the long sort of colorful thing, she set that to music. And then there are two dedications of merit, two different ones that she set to music. And if you know music at all, it might be very, and I brought the whole book for you, Samia. I thought you would enjoy it. Yeah. So I'll pass these around. Nobody is obligated to, but you might enjoy it. I wish I had a piano. I'd learn to play it. So this is the intro that, I brought enough, that I thought I'd start with before we plunge into the sutra itself. Okay. The name that it's known by is the Vajra Chedika Prajnaparamita Sutra, the diamond cutting. Vajra Chedika means diamond cutting. Prajnaparamita. Prajna we know. Paramita we know because we've studied the paramitas, the six bodhisattva paramitas, the practices of a bodhisattva. Generosity, morality, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. And Prajnaparamita is the wisdom perfection. And sutra is string. It's all strung out together. It's a very ancient word. It goes way back before Buddha. It's how they experienced the words, I think, as they came out in a string. So prajna can mean to cut through. There's the other kind of jnana, the other kind of wisdom, the vijna, which also means to cut. But it means to cut up into bits and pieces so that the seamless world becomes full of things. So that the wisdom of ordinary life is full of chairs and tables and cars and trucks and all the things that we have names for, and begin to consider as separate from everything else. Prajna is the way of cutting through that illusion and seeing that actually it's all of one piece. It's all together. Nothing is separate from anything else. There is no such thing as separation. So it also means to radiate light. It also means indestructible. Indestructible wisdom. It's a diamond also. And also means the three bodies of the Buddha. The Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Nirmanakaya. The way of saying the whole kit and caboodle, and then the way the kit and caboodle is actually manifesting as Buddha. Hongzhen was the teacher of Huineng, and this was his favorite sutra. This is the sutra that sent Huineng up to find him, because he heard it being chanted in his village 1,000 miles away. And he said, "Where did you hear it?" And he said, "Oh, the master is way up north." So Huineng went way up north and met Hongzhen. And Hongzhen said, "This sutra is present in the nature of all beings. It's an expression of something. The body of the Buddha." So the story is that the Buddha taught this Diamond Sutra when he was 65 years old in 400 BC. So it was long after his enlightenment. It teaches how to transform attachments and delusions to become a Buddha. It teaches how to abandon all views. So his first teaching, when he was enlightened, he went back to his friends, and his first teaching, the first turning of the wheel, was about realizing impermanence and interdependence. That's a very big teaching. It's one that we're all extremely aware of right now. It's on everyone's lips. It's all so impermanent. And we're all involved. wherever and however something happens, it's happening to us. We feel it, we know it. And it makes us very aware of our own impermanence. If the world can shake in one place or another place, it can shake in this place too. And in some way will for each one of us. So his first teaching was very powerful teaching, because he realized that our suffering comes from not accepting that truth, those truths. That the more we build an illusion around our life that everything is going to stay just the way we like it and we'll always have it, we suffer and suffer as things fall away. So in his later teaching, it's about emptiness. And in the sense of the Diamond Sutra, even emptiness is empty. As we say in the Heart Sutra, I always say the Heart Sutra is like the teachings are up on, written on a blackboard, and we take a big eraser and say, well, none of this, and none of this, and none of this, and none of this either. The wheel of change, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, no, no, no. Why would he do that? Because those are just ideas. And so if we become attached to those as ideas, then suddenly we're back in the grasp of our own grasping. So after Buddha's parinirvana, his death, of course, they all promised to carry on, and they immediately started breaking up into different groups with different ideas about what Buddha said and how to practice and how Buddha thought they should practice, and the inevitable individuality that always grows up in every group. And in a few centuries then, there were a couple of serious schools. One was the Theravadins, who to this day are the fundamentalists, you could say. They are the ones who guard and keep the original teachings as best they can. The original teachings, of course, were all in speech, not writing. Some people think that oral tradition was more accurate than writing tradition, that fewer mistakes were made when you trained a young person to memorize vast amounts of material, that that person would contain that material in complete accuracy. But if you tried to write it all down, there were inevitably mistakes made. So the Theravadins have tried to keep as much of the old stuff alive and pure. It's still being done. We still, the Theravadin tradition lives very well in this world. And the Wednesday night group is a sort of offshoot of the Theravadin tradition, the Vipassana. There was another group called the Mahasanghikas who also considered themselves keepers of Buddha's teaching, of course. And they split up into 18 different sects. And two of them were based on the wisdom teachings, which developed out of their practice. And it was based on emptiness and compassion, self-knowledge, upaya, meaning skillful means, to be willing to go wherever you need to go and skillfully deal with whatever it is. And instead of holding to the exact teachings of Buddha, it was more about developing what some people call cosmic consciousness, allowing the mind to open to greater mind, you could say, what Suzuki Roshi called big mind. That in ordinary, everyday life, we use our mind in order to solve our problems and get from one place to another and take care of ourselves. But when we sit down and become quiet, we become aware of a great deal more that's going on, a great deal more that our whole life contains. We don't really have a name for that. It's too big to name. But we all are it. And so they began writing about it. And the Diamond Sutra was one of the things that they wrote. The Heart Sutra was another. The Prajnaparamita Sutras. There were Prajnaparamita Sutras in 10,000 lines, in 100,000 lines, in 400,000 lines. And they all pretty much say the same thing. And they're all pretty much a dialogue with Buddha. Somebody comes up to Buddha and says, tell us about dot, dot, dot. And Buddha says, oh, thank you for asking. And then he proceeds to speak. And then the Buddha speaking often is in the way of questions. Well, what do you think about this? And then the Bodhisattva who's asking says, oh, I think this. And the Buddha says, well, and then he goes and gives a teaching about it. That's what this Diamond Sutra is. It's a dialogue between Buddha and Subhuti. Subhuti is one of Buddha's followers, one of his disciples, who stayed with him for many, many years and was highly respected. So the rest of this is things that people have said about the Diamond Sutra. It teaches a way of being in the world without being of it. Red Pine says it's all about bodies, not emptiness. And as you'll see, it's a very body-oriented little teaching. It's also about bodhisattva practice, bodhisattva insight. Insight into emptiness of the world doesn't make them withdraw, which was what the original Theravadin's practice was about. Withdrawing and becoming enlightened, working very, very hard to become enlightened in order to transcend the world, in order to achieve nirvana, peace. And at a certain point, that became so ingrown that the Mahayana tradition began to flourish. Because the idea that everyone should be involved in practice became much more important. It's not about me. It's about all of it. The whole thing. This is also very interesting in terms of language. It's about using language to deconstruct language, using language to deconstruct the names we have and the ideas that we have about the world. we're so sure that everything in our mind is real. And this is a sort of tricky way of keeping pulling it out from under us and saying, oh, you think so, do you? What about this? And you think, oh, yeah, okay, that's true. And then the whole thing comes up in another way and then another way. So it uses language to show us how we create a self and a world using words, using the ideas on which our words are based, and to see that it's mind. It's just our mind. And what we're making up, although it's amusing and charming and wonderful often, it's quite provisional, and it's a filtered version of what we actually experience, a very highly filtered version. Because as we experience things, we pick and choose, and only choose the things that we think are going to be good for us, or we also try to not choose the things that we think won't be good for us, the things we want, the things we don't want. And so we end up not with a true version of the world, but just the stuff that we think is us. It's weird, isn't it? So each one of us is a world in that way. And yet it's not a very accurate world. It's why I always thought Buddha was a scientist, because he took the questing scientific mind instead of just accepting how his mind was working. He studied it deeply and very bravely. His experience under the tree was a very scary one in many ways. It was very challenging. Everything came up for him. The good and the bad. Infinite number of temptations. And he stayed put because he wanted to see how things really were. And he stayed and stayed until finally all that temptation had to flee. Give him some space. Give him some place from which to see. And what he saw was a star. Just a star. So, I hope you will read the first section. Hope you'll read the whole thing. It's very quick. I hope you read it many times. Lots of people memorize it. And then I'll talk about it week after next. I'm going to Taos on Thursday, and I'll be back week after next. I don't remember who's going to be here. Donalyn. Thank you. Thank you very much. I will miss you. I'm sitting Sesshin at Hokoji, and then a little one day at Desert Mirror Sangha in Albuquerque. So I always like going to New Mexico, and I always miss you all very much. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. I'll be glad to get back too. So are there questions?
Sutra is one of the main considered Eastern Japanese Buddhism, sort of considered one of the main. That and the Lotus Sutra are both sort of the main Buddhist scriptures to refer to.
And the heart. Yeah.
Of which we chant a very abbreviated version.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's those are that's the kernel of the teaching in the Mahayana tradition. Yeah. So it was a good choice, you all. I'm really pleased about this. This is going to be very interesting. There are other versions of the translation, and there are other commentaries as well. So a lot of it you can look up online. The libraries have it too. So if you want to follow through and see what other people have to say about it, there's lots of material to check out. Sorry, I didn't see you.
No problem. I think my translation calls it the Diamond Sutra of Vatsyayana. Somebody named Vatsyayana. But I don't remember who that person was.
You don't know who translated it?
Oh, yeah, somebody named some Chinese guy, and somebody named Joe Miller. It's an ancient translation that I've had for forever.
Yes, yes.
I'll bring it in.
There's another ancient one with an American and a Chinese translator.
I think that's the one. Yeah. I probably have a note.
Well, it has good footnotes.
Yeah.
So I'm using that one too. I'm using Thich Nhat Hanh and that one and this one. And Musong has one. Musong, the physicist, Zen priest, wrote a whole book about it also. Which, if you're really scientific in the sense of physics, is very interesting, because this teaching is what particle physicists have begun to realize the truth of, to their amazement, which is very cool. Well, why don't we sit for the last 5 minutes?